I am not beholden to anyone but my constituents.
A Homer representative defends her use of official letterhead in criticizing a local newspaper. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a Department of Defense team exhumes the remains of an unknown soldier in Sitka.
There's a really good case that they're one of a short list of possible matches.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Alaska State House's Ethics Committee says Homer Republican Representative Sarah Vance likely violated state law by using publicly funded resources to criticize a local newspaper's coverage of a Charlie Kirk memorial last year. That's according to a decision released Thursday, finding a letter Vance wrote to Homer News owner Carpenter Media on official letterhead and posted to her official social media account constituted partisan political activity. A state law known as the Legislative Ethics Act bars the use of official resources for partisan activity. Vance says she disagrees with the committee's finding that the letter constitutes partisan activity. She says she sees the Ethics Committee's decision as an attempt to police how she speaks for her constituents.
I am not beholden to anyone but my constituents, and my letterhead is an expression of my representation. It is not state issued, and so I had every right to call out the media for what I believe to be biased reporting.
The committee cited several excerpts from Vance's letter as illegal partisan activity. One said, quote, if the paper continues to treat community events as opportunities for partisan spin, the consequence will be financial as well as reputational, end quote. The committee did not impose fines or other sanctions on Vance, saying the only corrective action necessary was a reminder of the proper use of state letterhead. Representative Kevin McCabe, a Big Lake Republican on the Ethics Committee, issued a lengthy dissent from the decision, saying he was concerned about the precedent it would set. The September 2025 letter led a Canadian editor with Carpenter Media to modify the Homer News story without the input of its Alaska-based staff. That led several reporters at Carpenter's three Alaska papers, in Juneau, Homer, and Kenai, to resign. Some now write for a new outlet, the Homer Independent Press, which first reported the Vance decision late last month. President Trump has pardoned a diesel mechanic from Wasilla, who was convicted of removing pollution control equipment from diesel vehicles. Trump granted full clemency on Friday to Mackenzie Spurlock, co-owner of Matanuska Diesel. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan celebrated Spurlock's pardon. He and other critics of the equipment say it often fails in temperatures lower than 12 degrees. Sullivan sponsored a bill that would require the Environmental Protection Agency to rewrite its rule to accommodate cold climates. At a hearing in March, Sullivan said the D.C. lawyers writing the rules do not feel their impact.
It's the truck drivers, mechanics, equipment operators, farmers out on remote highways doing the hard work that keeps our communities supplied and our economy moving.
Spurlock was accused of disabling emissions equipment on pickup trucks and a van, 20 vehicles in all, his attorney wrote. His pardon was announced along with those of seven other men convicted of violating the Clean Air Act. They either removed required devices from diesel vehicles or sold equipment to do the conversions. Clean air advocates oppose weakening the law that reduced smog in American cities. At the March hearing, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island says the pollution control equipment for diesel vehicles dramatically reduced emissions of nitrogen oxide, or NOx.
NOx causes lung disease, reproductive issues, birth defects, kidney problems, nerve damage, autoimmune disease, and cancer.
Spurlock did not respond to a phone message left at his shop. He was charged in 2023 and sentenced last year to 5 years probation. The pardon restores all his civil rights. Well, a federal judge in Anchorage is set to rule on a lawsuit over the future of the proposed pebble mine in the headwaters of Bristol Bay. That's after arguments in late June and a lawsuit challenging the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's authority to block the controversial mining project's development. KDLG's Jesse Sheldon reports.
The hearing was the latest in the 16-year-long battle over the proposed Pebble Mine. Both the plaintiffs and defendants dove into the weeds of administrative law, presenting arguments on salmon genetics, federal jurisdiction over water, and the definition of a fishery. Northern Dynasty Minerals, a Canada-based company, owns Pebble Limited Partnership, which oversees the mine's planning and is suing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, challenging its authority to veto this development. Mike Heatwall manages public affairs for Pebble.
Ever since the EPA started their actions against the project back in 2010, from our perspective, their actions were illegal, especially this preemptive veto.
The state of Alaska and two native corporations, Iliamna Native Limited and the Alaska Peninsula Corporation, joined Pebble in trying to overturn the EPA's decision. The proposed copper, gold, and molybdenum mine site is in the headwaters of Bristol Bay, the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery. Citing both Alaska and U.S. constitutions, the state's attorney argued it's Alaska's job to be the primary regulator of state land and water use. Pebble's arguments focused on the difference between the words likely and will. The company stated that the EPA's findings were speculative and that significant likely risks to the fishery found by the agency do not equate to the, quote, unacceptable adverse effects required for a veto. Heatwall says this is a core component of their case.
We have been contesting the EPA's malfeasance in our case for quite some time. We thought our attorneys presented strong arguments in the case, and now it's really up to the judge.
The EPA and nearly two dozen parties are defending the agency's decision, citing Section 404C of the Clean Water Act, which gives the EPA veto authority. The agency has used that authority just 14 times since the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. Here's Daniel Chayette.
That gives the EPA the right to say, we believe that this project cannot discharge into waters of the United States safely, that it poses too great a risk to the fisheries or to fish habitat.
Chayette is the Senior Vice President of Legal and Lands at Bristol Bay Native Corporation, one of the 23 groups intervening in the case on behalf of the EPA. The EPA argued in court that extensive records clearly show that salmon habitat would be damaged. Chayette says these records justify the agency's block on Pebble's development.
We believe that the EPA, in issuing its final determination, relied on a voluminous administrative record that contained lots of good science and firm basis for it taking action to protect the region from the risk posed by the proposed Pebble mine.
While supporters of the mine say its operations will bring jobs to the region, Chayette says those jobs are not worth jeopardizing the region's ecosystem.
The folks that are concerned about what this mine could do to the region and its fisheries and its subsistence and culture, they're not going away. And we will continue to be as invested as we have always been.
U.S. District Judge Sharon Gleason heard more than 2 hours of arguments. She said she will make a final determination on the case soon. In Dillingham, I'm Jesse Sheldon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a housekeeper sees her first bear inside Juneau's historic Alaskan hotel.
I'm very excited to see the bear here, but I never expected that I would see the bear like in the hotel.
That bear is coming up. Stay with us. A team of experts is working to salvage a Coast Guard helicopter that crashed on Sitka's Harbor Mountain last month. The U.S. Coast Guard said in a press release that the effort is being led by the downed aircraft recovery team from the Alaska Army National Guard. The group plans to assess the aircraft for its removal, recover the wreckage, and mitigate hazardous materials at the crash site. The MH-60 Jayhawk from Air Station Sitka went down on June 22nd during a training flight. The crash occurred at about 1,500 feet on the south side of Harbor Mountain. The four crew members involved in the crash were treated for minor injuries and released from Mount Edgecombe Medical Center the same day. The cause of the crash is being investigated by a team of Coast Guard members and civilian experts. They have not given a timeline on how long the investigation will take. The, quote, very hazardous crash site remains closed by the U.S. Forest Service and is currently under video surveillance. Several trees were damaged in the crash, but there was no reported damage to the local trail or road system. Harbor Mountain Road remains open to pedestrian traffic but is still closed to vehicles. The Coast Guard said they will encourage the reopening of the road once teams fully assess the site and determine no additional risks remain. Crews from Coast Guard Air Station Kodiak remain in Sitka to support operations in Southeast Alaska, with the goal of Sitka crews resuming their duties sometime this week. Two cruise ships in Southeast Alaska have reported norovirus outbreaks in recent weeks, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Ruby Princess, a Princess Cruises ship, had more than 100 of its roughly 3,000 passengers fall ill, as well as more than 20 crew members. The National Geographic Seabird also reported a norovirus outbreak. More than a quarter of the 68 passengers on the smaller vessel fell ill, as well as one of its crew members. Louisa Castrodale manages the infectious disease program at the Alaska Department of Health. She says noroviruses are a family of highly infectious gastrointestinal diseases that cause vomiting and diarrhea.
This is a family of viruses and illness that happens year-round and kind of everywhere. And it can become explosive when you have these settings where you have a lot of people in confined spaces.
Castrodale says the state does not track norovirus cases locally, but it does receive reports of outbreaks from the CDC and helps get information out to local communities that could be affected. Castrodale says the best way to prevent norovirus from spreading is by following good sanitation practices like hand washing and cleaning with disinfectants. The remains of an unidentified World War II soldier buried in Sitka have been successfully exhumed and are now headed to a Midwest forensics lab for possible identification. The unknown serviceman, known simply as X-3, was disinterred by the Department of Defense Agency team over the course of 5 days. As KCAW's Hope McKinney reports, Sitka was the third burial site for the unknown soldier, and officials hope to give his remains a final resting place.
More than 100 Sitkins line the street in silence as a procession of police and fire vehicles accompany the hearse carrying the remains of X-3 to the airport. A team of 5 from a Department of Defense agency just wrapped up a week on the island disinterring the unknown soldier from the Sitka National Cemetery, where he's been buried for nearly 8 decades.
It was a very successful and respectful, honorable extraction. And so we had challenges with X-3, but ultimate success.
Aaron Cummings is a senior planner with the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA, which is in charge of recovering and identifying missing service members from conflicts worldwide. He uses an analogy for how disinterments come about and the multiple levels of approval they face. He says imagine them like cold cases, and the DPAA's historians and analysts are like detectives who pore over old war records, pursuing clues to put a case together, arguing why specific unknown remains should be dug up.
In the situation of these disinterments, they were able to put enough pieces together to determine that the folks that we're disinterring, there's a really good case and a really good likelihood that they're one of a short list of possible matches.
Cummings says hundreds of servicemen from World War II were lost in or in the waters around Alaska and were either never found or never identified. In this case, there's evidence X-3 is an unidentified soldier who was killed in a plane crash near Cold Bay during the Aleutian campaign in 1942.
16 lost, 6 bodies found, 5 of those 6 identified, which leaves us 10 never found.
A trapper buried 6 bodies that washed up on shore near his cabin until he could notify authorities. Cummings says the DPAA has been looking into the case since 2017, but progress stalled until a possible family member got involved.
We are an agency with finite resources, and there are approximately 81,000 missing from Vietnam, Korea, and World War II. And with those kind of numbers, it's hard to prioritize. It's hard to rack and stack your missions. And family interest is one of the elements that we utilize to determine how we prioritize and which missions move up the ladder.
While Cummings says all 11 unidentified or missing soldiers are possible matches, Chris Pfeiffer believes X-3 could be his great uncle, Second Lieutenant Eugene Christensen, the co-pilot of the C-53 that went down near Cold Bay. Pfeiffer has collected hundreds of pages about the crash and his uncle over the years, has pressured his congressman and the DPAA to disinter the remains, and even started a blog to document the process. He flew in from Texas for the disinterment and watched the process unfold from about 50 feet away.
Unless I got involved, it wasn't going to go anywhere. And so they mentioned that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And that's why we're here today.
Pfeiffer says he has a letter from the Army to his great-grandfather that says there's no chance of ever finding his son. He says the Army closed the door.
That wasn't true. And my great-grandparents passed away. My grandparents passed away. My parents passed away. And all of their brothers and sisters all passed away, not knowing what I know. And they could have known it. It could have been shared.
Cummings says the dig to exhume X-3's remains was unique and surprising in many ways. It was the agency's first disinterment in Sitka. The remains, which were located on a narrow step of the main hill at the National Cemetery, had to be hand-dug. He says the team also had to make a contraption out of wood to allow the archaeologist to hover over the casket on her stomach to access it. Despite the challenges, he says everything was intact. The remains were in a metal casket that was placed inside a wooden one.
Our extremely seasoned archaeologists had never seen anything like it.
The remains of X-3 left Sitka on July 1st for Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, where, through DNA analysis, the DPAA hopes to get a positive ID. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Hope McKenney.
A rare funnel cloud was spotted in a remote area south of the Denali Highway around 5 p.m. Saturday. National Weather Service meteorologist Christine Chen says observers at the Alpine Creek Lodge captured it on video.
This type of funnel cloud forms when we have winds moving in different directions. So we have just enough wind shear to create a rotating column of air that descends from the base of the thunderstorm.
Chen says the funnel cloud likely posed little threat to people on the ground because it never developed into a tornado.
There's not really any visible indications that it made contact with the ground, so therefore we're considering it a funnel cloud and not a tornado. Because the funnel cloud did not touch the ground, it likely would not have caused much damage or danger to people who are on the ground.
Only 6 tornadoes have ever been recorded in Alaska. Chen says funnel clouds might be more common than people realize, but it's highly unusual to have video like the one recorded from the Alpine Creek Lodge, which gave forecasters a rare look. The Weather Service says the funnel extended from the base of a towering cumulus cloud and was only visible for 15 minutes. Forecasters say it likely formed when Susitna Valley winds collided with winds driving a thunderstorm, enough to create wind shear and produce the spinning column of air that descended from the cloud base. A black bear entered Juneau's historic Alaskan hotel around noon on Sunday. Hotel staff say the bear let itself out with a loud crash just a short while later. KTOL's Alex Solomon has the story.
On the second floor of the Alaskan Hotel in Juneau, a black bear crawled into room 213 through a wide open window. The hotel is built into the hillside, so second floor windows are still at ground level. Queenie Lim is a housekeeper at the Alaskan. She says she was on her way to clean the room next to 213 when she saw the bear inside. She said she didn't believe her eyes, so she double-checked before calling other staff over.
So actually, I'm very excited to see the bear here, but I never expected I would see the bear, like, in the hotel.
Lim says it's her first summer in Alaska. She's in a cultural exchange program from Malaysia, and this is her first ever bear sighting. Diartha Yashari is a housekeeper who joined Lim on the scene.
I was just in shock.
Together, they saw the bear walk down the hall into the open door of room 208. Yashari says she, Lim, and one other person trapped the bear in the room.
One guest was here, a guy, and then he was like, oh, I'm interested to see the bear. And then he helped us to close the door, and then we called the police.
But by the time the police came, the bear was gone. Here's the police scanner radio chatter that a local resident recorded.
They heard a going over there, I'm sure.
The bear left behind not only shattered glass, but a big pile of scat on top. Betty Adams, owner of the Alaskan Hotel and Bar, says the bear must have been as nervous as the staff.
I can't believe it. It was having anxiety.
But what attracted the bear in the first place? The trash can in room 213 was tipped over. Hotel staff say it contained a mostly empty takeout food box and not much else. Adams says this is not the first time a bear has entered the establishment. In 2013, a bear walked right into the bar and the bartender yelled at it.
And she just went, get out of here, and just railed and waved her arms, and the bear just stopped, like, whoops.
She says it backed up and then walked back out the door. Adams says bears that have come into the Alaskan have always used doors in the past. This is the first time one has come and gone through the windows. Anthony Krupe is a regional supervisor for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Southeast. He says this is a lean time of year for bears in Juneau, so it's not a surprising time to see a lot of bear action downtown.
What they're consuming is really still not putting on a lot of weight. They're waiting for the salmon and the berries and abundant resources that come a little bit later in summer.
He says people should be vigilant about closing windows and storing trash where bears can't get it. In 2024, Fish and Game euthanized two bears that got aggressive around trash cans on Franklin Street, which is heavily populated with cruise ship tourists in the summer. Krupe says that if a bear enters a home or business, call the police. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Nearly 20 years ago, a California couple set out to play a game of croquet on the lawn of every state capital. They visited Juneau last month to complete their quest, except there's no lawn at Alaska's capital, no grass even. So how do you play croquet? KTOO's Jamie Deep finds out.
Ashton Buswell cheers on a rainy Saturday morning as his sister hits a croquet ball at the state capitol building in Juneau. His family set up the game in a bit of an unconventional spot. While croquet is typically played on a lawn, the Alaska State Capitol lacks one. Instead, the family settled for a mossy patch between the building's parking garage and back entrance. But a few minutes into the game, Capitol security stopped them and said they weren't allowed to play there. So they pivoted to playing outside the Juneau Douglas City Museum across the street. There's actually a lawn there.
This is a real course. Should we come down off the flat a little bit, maybe put the last wicket like...
The game continues with Buswell, his two sisters, and his wife taking turns to push balls through small wire gates called wickets. Their parents watch under the cover of the parking garage across the street. This is more than a game of croquet. It marks the end of a nearly 20-year-long quest to play croquet on the lawn of every state capital in Washington, D.C. Buswell says the idea originates decades ago, pre-marriage, when he played croquet while visiting Idaho's state capital. Years later, when he was going to get married, he floated the idea to add a croquet set to their wedding registry. His fiance at the time, now Lydia Buswell, upped the ante.
He told me the story about playing croquet, you know, on the state capitol, and jokingly I was like, well, if someone actually buys this for us for our registry, then we can play on all the capitals.
And I was like, yes, that's a great idea.
And someone actually bought us a croquet set for our wedding gift. And so I was like, okay, that's it.
Ashton Buswell's job back then took them to Sacramento, which felt like a great start. He says being a door-to-door salesman took them all over the country. They plotted ways to visit as many state capitals as possible on work trips and managed to reach 47 states in 4 years. Capitals in Hawaii, North Dakota, and Michigan required special trips. His two sisters joined them for the game in Juneau, their last state capital. Here's one of the sisters, Whitney Buswell.
It's been something kind of a lore in the family about them going and playing croquet on all the capitol lawns. So amazing to be part of this historic day for them to finish and accomplish the goal.
During this 20-year quest, the Buswells did other travel too. About a decade went by where they didn't visit any capitals. Then Ashton Buswell says his parents planned a cruise to Alaska to celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary, taking croquet into consideration.
There was a couple of options that didn't have Juneau in it. And he said, nope, we have to go to Juneau because he wanted to make sure that we could get our 50th capital.
He says his dad is an inspiration to making the trip to every capital. His dad also completed a 50-state journey earlier this year. Instead of croquet, he got haircuts in every state. The Buswells included family and friends in a couple of other states. Ashton Buswell says a couple of their four children joined them for one of the games in a different state. The couple says their next goal might be to play croquet at each national park and take more of their kids along for the ride. Ashton Buswell says he hopes their kids also find their own adventure to go on. Lydia Buswell wants them to enjoy whatever fun journey they end up on.
And nothing is too silly. Like, nothing is too stupid. Nothing is too beneath you to try, and especially if it's just for fun, you know?
After the game, the Buswells walked across the street back to the Capitol building. This time they hoped to get in for an official tour, another tradition they try to do when the time allows. Reporting next to the state Capitol building, I'm Jamie Deep.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone, Jamie Deep, and Alex Solomon in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jesse Sheldon in Dillingham, Hope McKinney in Sitka, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.